Or my favorite way to counter a price objection is if someone says, you know, you're too expensive, or whatever variation of the price objection you get, you of course can say compared to what is the classic objection response to that. But I might also say, so it sounds like price is the primary driver of your decision. Is that right? And often people will say, well, no, because no one wants to feel cheap. Right. So they'll usually say, well, no, that's not actually the case. And then we'd start a conversation. Well, what are the drivers of your decision? And now we get closer to the truth through that first no to take price off the table, at least somewhat.
This is Inside Selling, a podcast where we talk about how to sell without selling your soul in a way that feels comfortable for both you and your prospects. Today on the big show, the return of Liston Witherill. Liston, how are you, my long-lost friend?
Where is the applause track is my question.
It's post.
I'm good, man.
We do that in post.
Oh, okay. I'll just pretend that people are clapping for me. Thank you, Josh. I appreciate you adding that.
Liston, what are we talking about today?
Well, today we are talking about a book that we've both been reading, and in particular, a single chapter of that book. And the book is called Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss. And it is the best, or at least I think we agree that it's the best book on negotiation that we've ever read. And it's a little bit different because it's about an FBI negotiator who talks a lot about bailing hostages out of horrible situations, which is pretty much like our everyday life. So we thought this would be very relatable.
Yeah, it's interesting. The analogy that he uses when he negotiates, unlike a business negotiation where you can split the difference, in a hostage negotiation, it's not like you can say, well, yeah, you can kill two as long as you're released two. So a very interesting perspective for being able to get what matters most to you in a negotiation told from the perspective of an FBI negotiator. And every chapter starts with a hostage story and then ladders back to a lesson that you can directly apply to your sales situations, whether that's from a prospecting perspective or your conversations that you're having with prospects or when you're in a negotiation. And we're not going to talk about the entire book today, but we would like to talk about chapter 4. And the title of the chapter is Beware Yes, Master No. And so what's the problem, Liston? The problem we bump into, and I'd love to get your perspective on this, is as sales professionals, I think we have a tendency to want to ask people questions that they're going to answer yes to, because we're taught through various sales books and sales trainings that if we can get people to say yes a bunch of times, that eventually when we ask for the big yes or the sale, it will be easier. But this book takes a different type of an opinion on that, Liston.
Well, yeah. So one of the things that the author says is going after a yes may be a way to get people to appease us and to get us to get the hell away. And he talks about a telemarketing call. I think this was the big example he used, where they go, so let me ask you a question. Do you support helping children so that they don't have to die a premature death? Like, who's going to say no to that, right? And so they give you this set of leading questions that starts from general to more and more specific, whereby you're going to be agreeing in every single case, right? You're going to say, yes, okay, yeah, of course I want to help children. Or like my favorite, this is my favorite guilt trip that I see. When I go take my dog to the pet store to give him a bath, they say, will you help a homeless pet today? Yes or no are my only two options. And I'm like, this dog I have is a homeless pet before I got him. So I'm already helping a homeless pet. But basically what we want to do a lot of times is there's this drive to trap someone into saying yes. And what that's going to do is get you an insincere yes, I think is the big point that the author is making.
Totally correct. And the analogy that I like to use, if you've ever been in a mall and you've seen the people that work at those kiosks and they lock eyes with you and they say, can I ask you a question? you probably try to look away and not make eye contact. Or if they say, can I squirt some lotion on your hand? Because you're afraid of where they're going to lead you. If you agree to asking a question and you say yes, and you agree to getting the lotion squirted on your hand, what are they trying to get me to do? They're trying to get you to part with your money, the money that you worked really hard for. And that's where this awkwardness comes in with regards to sales. The pressure comes when you're moving faster than your prospect is ready. Are you trying to squirt the lotion and therefore making your prospect repel?
First of all, I think it's a wonderful opening line whenever you meet someone is to like squirt something on their hand. That's great. And you know what I like to do at the mall, if I'm asked, hey, can I ask you a question? This is great because it totally interrupts their whole script. You go, do you mean two questions? Because they're going to ask you another one. And they usually look dumbfounded by that. They're like, I don't know where to go from here. But yeah, I mean, it's really the epitome of an insincere, inauthentic kind of interaction, right? And so what we want to do is get away from that. And so what the author suggests is rather than getting into this, you know, pushing someone for a yes every single time, he recommends going for the no. And he talks a lot about how no can mean lots of different things. And actually, Josh, you taught me this, and I think it is worth noting that usually most people will take no, whether you are in sales or you're a business owner, whoever you are, most people will take no as no, get lost. I hate what you have. I never want to buy from you or talk to you again. And often what people actually mean by no is much more nuanced.
Totally. I mean, let's give some practical examples of what this might look like in a sales conversation. So for instance, I was having a sales conversation, a week or so ago with somebody, and they were asking, they had some sales trainer that they were already using. And the prospect said to me some version of, what's the difference between you as a sales trainer and the one I have right now? And your inclination as a salesperson, your reaction is going to be to defend and to start to tell the person why you and why you're better, right? That would be trying to get to yes. But after reading Chris Voss's book, I said to the person, that's a great question. Glad you asked it. Tell me a little bit about the trainer you're using now. And they went on, we're using, you know, this trainer. And I said, you know, I've heard of that trainer. They're fantastic. They have a great reputation. What's prompting you to even look for another trainer? And then they said, well, this trainer, you know, we tried to use their prospecting approach and we weren't even getting a lot of, you know, responses. And I said, mm-hmm. I got it. But, you know, all trainers, you know, go through that. They're not all going to increase your response rates by 100%. Even I can't get you 70 or 80%. You know, that's probably just part of the training. Like, is that such a big deal? Why don't you just get some more BDRs? Well, that prospect then started to open up even more and even more about why they wanted to change and why the status quo wouldn't work for them anymore. So again, it's a lesson of going a little negative, you know, hey, why, or actually say going a little positive, why not just stay with what you're doing? Trying to get to that no, like, hey, you know, maybe I should stay. And then what ends up happening is they kind of tell you why they want to switch rather than you telling them why they should switch.
Exactly. And, you know, one strategy that I would use is, you know, whether it's training or I do coaching or consulting, I'll say something like, so it sounds like this isn't a priority right now. Did I get that right? And sometimes they'll say, well, no, that's not the case. Or my favorite way to counter a price objection is if someone says, you know, you're too expensive or whatever variation of the price objection you get, you of course can say compared to what is the classic objection response to that. But I might also say, so it sounds like price is the primary driver of your decision. Is that right? And often people will say, well, no, because no one wants to feel cheap. Right. So they'll usually say, well, no, that's not actually the case. And then we'd start a conversation. Well, what are the drivers of your decision? And now we get closer to the truth through that first no to take price off the table, at least somewhat.
Totally. And one other example that Chris Voss used in the book was prospects that went dark. And he would send them just this one sentence email, and it said something like, you know, have you given up on this project? And he'd say, like, you know, nine times out, you know, no one wants to feel like they're giving up on something. So what I did this morning, I had a prospect that went dark on me, and I wrote, I'll just read you the sentence. And within 15 minutes, I got a barrage of emails back from this prospect. And the sentence, you know, was like this, and I'll protect the names of the people, but it was, you know, however, you know, despite numerous attempts, I haven't been able to connect with Lisa, nor have I been able to get examples of the emails I requested, which will allow me to see if I can help you. Typically when that happens, it means it's not a high priority right now, which is not a problem at all. I realize there are multiple forces competing for your time and attention. If this bubbles up to the top again, no worries. I'm here for you, John. Till then, Josh. And within less than literally 2 seconds, 5 minutes tops, I heard back from the prospect and the project is moving, you know, forward again.
Yeah, you know, I did something similar, and I was looking for the email, and I can't find it right in this moment. But I basically said, hey, I know you're super busy right now, and maybe this isn't the right time to do the project. So unless I hear from you, I'm just going to take you off my list, and I will not bother you anymore. You know, it's because it sounds like this isn't something you want to do at all. No worries, by the way.
Yeah, and I think this is also something we talk about all the time, listening to, is which is in sales, you want to come across as the personal trainer, not the waiter, right? You want to come across as the person that has the plan and that can get you there. So for me, I would hire a personal trainer that would say, Josh, I've assessed you. I know your goal is to finish a triathlon, and here's the plan that will get you across the finish line without crawling across the finish line, rather than a personal trainer that said, well, what do you want to do today? How do you want to work out? Or a waiter that'll just take your order. No, nothing against waiters. So not being needy and taking this position of abundance is very key, so that you come across as that personal trainer and not the waiter. Something else we could talk about is even applying this principle, which I've been doing actually after I read the book, to cold calling. You know, we're so, when we make a cold call, and we're always trying to get to yes. So I started to think, how can I apply this to booking a meeting with someone, or to try to book a meeting? And one of the examples Chris Voss used in the book is when he got Warren Buffett to speak at the college that he was lecturing. I don't know if you remember this story, listen.
I do.
But he was waiting in line for the book to get signed. And he got in front of Warren Buffett. And rather than saying, hey, can you speak in front of the college? He said something like, you know, would it be crazy if you came to my college and spoke in front of the students? And by phrasing it like that, Warren Buffett ended up leaning forward and said, no, that wouldn't be crazy. He felt safe. And he ended up speaking at the college. So I thought, hey, could I apply that to cold calling? So what I've been doing, experimenting with, is I'll say something like, you know, hey, notice that you guys have an SDR team, that you're setting meetings with these gaming app developers. Would it be presumptuous of me to think that you'd want some more meetings with those game developers? Some help setting meetings with more people like them. Is that crazy for me to think? Is that presumptuous of me? And kind of phrasing it like that, oftentimes I'm seeing if it takes the pressure off. I haven't had enough time to play with it, listen, but would love to get your perspective on what you think of that.
Well, okay. So just like my example of the, will you help a homeless pet today, right? Or will you help a child with cancer? The reason it works is because it creates a little bit of guilt. So let's go back to the Warren Buffett example. So I love this one because, first of all, it worked, and it obviously, scoring Warren Buffett to come talk to your class is a major coup, no matter who you are, even if you're a best-selling author, because obviously Warren Buffett has a million other things he could be doing. Now, what's really going on there is it's basically implying, Warren, I'm sure your time is way too valuable, and I'm too small, and you don't really care about my class that much. That's the implication, right? In the inverse. If I were to say it in a positive way, rather than, you know, would it be crazy if, and if someone did that to me, I'm immediately like, you know what? I don't want to talk to you. Mm-hmm. Like, that was so manipulative. I just don't like it. Now I recently did a personality test, Josh, and you probably wouldn't be surprised to know that I am, called what's called the commander, and I'm 3% or less of the population, and I'm extremely hard to get along with. So I know that I'm more direct, and it would be more off-putting to me than other people, particularly people who are more agreeable. So I'm wondering, like, do you worry about that, or not? Worry is not the right word, but is that something that you think about, where it could be extremely off-putting to some people?
Yeah, to me, it felt when I did it, and I've only done it a couple of times. It felt unnatural to me to phrase it like that on a cold call. Uh-huh. You know, I felt more natural to me to say, you know, would you be open to some new perspectives that might help your SDR team get in front of more gaming app companies like A, B, and C? Is that something you'd be open to learning about? Rather than, would it be crazy for me to think? To me, that sounded more like salesy and like I was trying too hard. But for some reason, in an email, when I say, you know, feel free to say no if you don't see a fit, but might we be able to help you? That to me seems more natural for some reason. I don't know why.
Well, yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it does feel gimmicky. And, you know, I think it for me, it feels gimmicky because it is. You know, and I don't know. I guess the final jury on whether or not it's gimmicky is the person you're speaking to.
Yeah.
And so, you know, often when we think about optimizing sales or even optimizing marketing messages, we would just ask the question, well, what's more likely to work? Now, so if you got a conversion on this, or you were able to open 20% more conversations, of course you would go with it. I think for me, would it be crazy to assume X, Y, or Z? It just feels a little bit off.
Yeah.
Now, I did want to talk about something that Chris talks about in the book, which is the true meaning of no. Because I alluded to that a little bit earlier, and I think he shares something that's really great. And he says, when someone tells you no, I'm reading from the book right now, you need to rethink the word in one of its alternative and much more real meanings. Number one, I am not yet ready to agree. Number two, you are making me feel uncomfortable. Number three, I don't understand. Number four, I don't think I can afford it. Number five, I want something else. Number six, I want more information. Number seven, I want to talk it over with someone else. Now, in each of these meanings, that no is so powerful, right? And what we really want to do, and I think the big point he's saying is, if we get to the no faster, we can start to parse which of those no's does it actually mean.
Totally. And I also think, you know, context matters as well. That conversation to me seems more natural, like in that scenario we talked about earlier, where someone says, how is your widget different than the widget I'm currently using? And you kind of say, well, why would you want to switch from the widget that you're currently using? Maybe they say, well, yes, it's not doing X, Y, and Z. Well, no widget's perfect all the time. Our widgets go down 10% of the time too. So why not just deal with it, or, you know, kind of work around it? And that to me seems like a more natural environment when you're almost trying to talk someone out of change, to see how much energy there is. I call it like the sort of barometer, if you will, of switching, you know, the switch barometer, like where are they on a scale of 1 to 10? Because if they're at a 2 or a 3, you're probably going to spin your wheels a lot chasing, rather than if they're at a 7 or an 8. And by phrasing these questions and letting the prospect convince you essentially into why they want to switch, you can kind of see where they are on that barometer, to see if it's worth, you know, spending some time with that prospect further.
Yeah, totally. I mean, whenever I think about pretty much any software that I use and I go on to a demo, they say, well, what are you using now? And I pretty much, and they, of course, why did you choose that? And I always say, because it's true, well, I choose the software that I hate the least, because it all has some sort of, you know, pain in the ass moment, or thing that I have to work around, because it's not built for me, right? It's built for 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 people. And I look at that always as such a huge open door for the person to say, well, tell me a little bit about that. Like, why did you hate this one the least? What made you switch to it? Like, there's so much rich conversation that can happen there, and very few people actually walk through that door, because I basically said, you know, no, I don't really want to do anything else, but I hate this thing. And it's an opening for them. And they could say, well, why switch at all if you already hate this one the least? And then I could justify it to them.
Yeah, I think this comes down to what we always talk about, Liston, which is people, we believe, you know, people switch for their reasons and on their timeline, not yours. And so if you're not hearing it from the prospect and you're the one doing the convincing and they're saying yes and giving you these really short answers, that's a red flag. Rather than what Liston's talking about, which is you kind of phrase these questions and you let people, you know, you kind of talk yourself out of it and you see how much energy there is behind switching.
Well, let me ask you this. So, you know, Chris in this book in chapter 4, the one we're covering now, he talks, by the way, we're on a first name basis. Chris Voss is his name. Sorry, Mr. Voss. He talks about prompting either yes or no questions. Now, my approach to sales typically is to encourage people to ask open-ended questions. So how do you balance this need for prompting a decision point, yes or no, with the need to ask these open-ended questions to really engage in richer conversation?
Well, there's like an arc to the sale, right? I think at the very beginning of a conversation, you're trying to get an understanding of what their current situation is and what the reason is that they are speaking to you. And so I don't like to think of it as like, I have to ask open-ended questions. I have to be able to get some information from someone and have a base level understanding of where they are and where they want to be and what obstacles they're bumping into and what things they might not have considered before. And so I can mix in these, I guess, situational questions at the beginning to get a base level of understanding and confirm, and then switch to, you know, quote unquote, more, you know, open-ended questions. But closed-ended questions could turn into open-ended questions by just saying, can you tell me more about that? Can you give me an example?
Right. And of course, you should be doing that if you're in a sales role. Anytime you get a yes or a no, you want them to elaborate on that a little bit.
Totally. The book is Never Split the Difference, Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It by Chris Voss. Both Liston and I highly recommend this book. We may talk about some other chapters in other podcasts. There's so much rich information, but it's a highly recommended read.
I need you to add the applause track if you want me back.
I will add the applause track. Liston, thank you so much for the conversation. It's always a pleasure speaking with you.
Great. My pleasure too, Josh.